SciByte is produced by JupiterBroadcasting.com, independent entertainment that's on demand. Check us out. Hi everyone, you're listening to SciByte, Jupiter Broadcasting's weekly science podcast. We recorded this one live on February 21st for release on February 22nd. That's a Wednesday. My name is Chris, and joining us like every single week is our host, Heather. Hey there, Heather.
Hello there, Chris.
Hey, happy science to you, Heather.
Happy science.
Hey, what do we have coming up on today's SciByte?
Today, we're going to take a look at support class satellites, the newest space station crew member, Robonaut, how science once again has caught up to ancient herbal remedies, spray-on antennas, drunk fruit flies, viewer feedback, and as always, take a peek back into history and up in the sky this week.
Wow, sounds like we got a big show this week.
We do. Hopefully, I don't get sidetracked and babble like I sometimes do.
I think people like that. I actually wanted to just say thanks. I realized I was going through my inbox this morning trying to find a few things. I've gotten a bunch of emails from people who said how much they love SciByte. And so it's really nice to hear from people and say they enjoy it. Also, I hear from a lot of people who say they like the whole last TechSnap SciByte combo for their commuting needs. So that's really cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I wanted to say thanks to everybody. And of course, you can always email the show, SciByte@JupiterBroadcasting.com, or leave a comment wherever you watched or listened to this, and we try to read those too. Oh, yeah.
Or fill in the form on the website.
That's right. We have the contact form, and it does get used, and you can always use that. Heather, what do you say? Since we got a big show, why don't we jump into our first news story? Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
All right, let's hit it off.
All right.
What is our first story this week?
Support class satellites. Now, I was looking at some of these, and I do want to thank Metal Freak as well. He kind of sent the same story in, making sure I didn't skip it, didn't miss it. There are a couple different kinds of satellites that we're talking about here. One, cleanup. We've talked about it before, where there's a whole bunch of stuff out there. The space station has to move every once in a while to avoid, you know, all this junk in orbit. You know, so it's some of it is dead satellites, but a lot of the dangerous junk is where satellites have collided with each other, where paint chips from the space shuttle have been knocked off, you know, where they've dropped a toolbox or all these kind of different things where it has a whole lot of these smaller objects just orbiting the Earth in unknowable ways. So there's a Swiss company who has sort of gotten a satellite together where they would send it up, and they would send something up. It would kind of track a satellite. It would be a big enough piece that they could actually track, go up to it, and grab. And then they would dive it down into the atmosphere and burn it up. So these are probably more like smaller satellites or big chunks of stuff that they could actually sort of track, go up to it, grab with a little hook, like they're playing in a grocery store or something. You know, you aim, you go down, you get the little stuffed animal and get rid of it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Those things always are designed to steal your money.
Yeah, but this one hopefully will work more often than those.
Totally, because otherwise it's going to be pretty disappointing.
Yeah. Now, it's the Clean Space One. They haven't really done anything with it yet. And like I said, this is more for like total satellites. But it is interesting. It's kind of exciting that we're moving in the direction that there's actual things that can go out there and do stuff with this. So if a satellite's been hit and there's a big chunk of it sitting there, like the main part of the satellite's still there.
This is like Wall-E for real life.
Yeah.
So how do they launch stuff all the time and not run into junk? Do they have like an idea of where the junk is?
Yeah, NASA tracks 16,000 of them, anything larger than about 10 centimeters. Mm. Five-ish inches in diameter, they can track.
Okay.
So a lot of these delicate satellites and, you know, deep space probes or extraplanetary probes, they start going off with a little shield around them. So, and they knock those off at a certain point.
Oh.
In orbits. And then they go down and burn up. So kind of has a little protective shield for a little while and then kicks that free and kind of gets it past some of that, some of that smaller debris. And they can track a lot of the smaller stuff. So they'll, if possible, you know, they'll try to aim for windows of less junk.
Sure, sure.
But I mean, we've said, we've heard before, the space station has to, you know, sidestep sometimes for pieces of larger debris that get too close.
I guess it's just really a problem because anybody can send anything up there, huh? And yeah, there's no real, like, there's no dumping ground laws or anything like that up in space.
Well, there are, I don't know if there are official rules, but there are dead satellite orbits.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, where, you know, what you're parking orbit. You know, once you're done, you're supposed to aim for here.
Right.
And be there. But occasionally there are these satellites that something catastrophic happens, or, you know, it just dies in some weird way that you can't, you know, send it to a parking orbit, mm-hmm. or to collide for various odd reasons. So, I mean, these kind of things do happen, but a lot of them, you know, you're supposed to put them in a dead satellite orbit, but this cleanup, Clean Space One is sort of aimed to do the ones that maybe can't get to the parking orbit, or, you know, or maybe they want to be able to go clean up the parking orbit.
It seems like you gotta have a pretty advanced piece of machinery up there that can go up there and very safely move into this stuff that would theoretically be whipping around the Earth and then attach to it or whatever it's got to do and then bring it down to burn up. That doesn't seem like a very basic procedure to me.
No, that is some of the big things that they're kind of worried about, is because if things are moving so quickly out there, they're so quickly and so high, it's just, how do you make sure that it is precision? I mean, you don't want to ram into it and make even more debris out of your cleanup satellite.
Right.
And you have to clean up the cleanup satellite, and it's not a good thing.
No.
Not the best thing in the world.
That's a bit of a failure.
Yeah. But in the same way, I mean, there are some of these satellites that, you know, they've run out of fuel or something's happened to them, but the satellite dish, the communications dish, is still there. It's still perfectly good. And it is a hard piece of equipment to launch from ground to orbit. So the United States Department of Defense is looking at what they could do to have a satellite go up and sort of junkyard pickers
scavenge.
Yeah, scavenge the dishes off of those and attach them to new satellites. That would be, you know, much cheaper and easier to launch than go snag yourself a radio dish and you're pretty set.
That's awesome.
That would be awesome. The trick of the matter is these kind of dishes were not really assembled in orbit. So there's, you know, they may be big and bulky to get up there, but once they're up there, kind of tricky because there's nuts and bolts and they weren't really attached on there. You want to make them sure they're attached very, right. Very well.
Yeah.
And so it's finding a sort of satellite that would be able to look and, you know, go out and unscrew this nut or bolt and not make sure it doesn't just fly away.
Or building future satellites with the intention of being disassembled in space.
Yeah. But for right now, there's, you know, the idea is there's a whole bunch of them up there now. And can you repurpose the ones up there now? So how do you make a satellite that can go up there, do that, that could be used for more than one type of satellite that could go up, not just the ones where the bolts for attachment are 6.23 inches apart, then go back 7.25 inches. You know, there's very specific layouts for all these different types of connections. So you have to be able to do any sort of combination.
Well, and like Crash Benedict in the chat room points out, is they're probably pretty fragile, so you could also potentially break them.
Yeah, some of them, you know, they're various degrees of fragility, so you don't want to break what you're trying to do, and then again, need a cleanup satellite, break what you're trying to get.
But then again, like, so take the case of, like, Phobos Grunt, if that was theoretically, if they could have flown something over that and scavenged parts off of it before it burned up, who cares if you damage them? Because you're gonna crash land that thing anyways.
Yeah.
It, And so maybe you could just go get a few like a solar panel or something like that.
Yeah.
Pretty neat. Bring it back to the, and then curry it back to the International Space Station where they stow it for somebody to come get it. I don't know what they do with it at that point. I mean, somebody's got to come get it, but.
Yeah, I mean, between that and the cleanup between those two type of satellite ideas, could you go out, grab something and bring it back to the station for identification? And can you plug into the side to the essentially the serial port? Would you be able to put something on there so they could talk to it?
Right.
Or lay eyes on it and be like, oh, this is what the problem is. Yeah, we can't do that. Or maybe I think we can fix that.
That's probably,
you know, and then attach something to, if you can't do anything for it and you've scavenged all the pieces off you can, then have the cleanup satellite dump it in a very precise manner in a very specific location.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know what? That's probably the use case, like down the road, has got to be the International Space Station or some sort of long-term manned space station would have something like this, you'd think, where they would just be able to send it out. Because from up there, they got to be able to see stuff all the time. If they could just send out a little drone, isn't the right word, but a little drone to go out there and collect something and bring it back to the International Space Station, this seems like something they should just have all the time. I bet they add something like this.
I think we could get AAA to have an on-orbit service.
Yeah, I hear they're great. I've never had them, but I hear they're great. Yeah.
I mean, we won't make them hold to 30 minutes or less or whatever their time limit is, but, you know, we won't hold them tight to a schedule.
Well, let me ask you this. So how do you keep something powered, something like this that flies around and cleans up space or flies around and recycles components? Is it just solar powered? Do you put a gas station up in space? What do you do?
Well, yeah, a lot of them are solar powered, so they're going to be able to pull, pull power from the sun. But a great deal of them are actually onboard liquid fuels. Mm. So you have frozen liquid fuels that are on there and have a very specific time limit. You know, they are going to last 9 months or they are going to last 2 years. So there's another idea. A Canadian-based aerospace company is designing a spacecraft that would be able to maybe go up to a satellite that had run out of liquid helium and hook up to it and sort of put more fuel into it, a refueling station.
So like in a orbit, space fueling tanker.
Yeah, a space fueling tanker. The problem is there are some issues that they're going to have to get over is that most of these are super cooled and critical liquids. How do you store them long term? How do you keep enough on the satellite so that it has enough to maneuver and get to places and have the ability to load tank up a couple of satellites? And
again, the satellites have to be able to accept an external connection like that.
Yep.
And it's, you know, so it's almost, again, that almost sounds like something they'd have to build into future satellites.
Yeah. So there is that idea. And there's, you know, all the connections and lining up and, you know, all these things have a lot of the same issues where it's lining up a satellite, not ramming into it, having to be able to connect in some sort of way. And are we just looking at ones that we already have? Are we looking towards the future? You know, design everything to the future so that it's more, round peg and round hole instead of a square peg.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting, these kind of things, because I was looking at that and then looking at the three articles, and I kind of found it amusing that we were kind of reduce, reuse, recycle in satellites.
Yeah, well, seriously, it is. And you could think about it, too. Like, people are a little tight on funds. And if you could sort of breathe an entirely new life into a satellite, if you had some sort of other refueling satellite, that could be extremely economical for some of these companies.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you put, millions into this satellite. You've had it launched. It was working fine. It's still working fine. It just lacks, maneuvering thrusters and things to be able to continue its orbit, or maybe more fuel. Or so what if these type of satellites in the future, we can roboticize things so that you could, maybe a company has it so that, there's a fuel tanker company that says, hey, pay me this and I'll go up and I'll refuel you.
Yeah.
Or I'll top you off with a couple of gallons of this.
Could be big business in the future satellite repairman gig. You never know. I think I like what Jukesman in the chat room is saying is become a satellite repairman, be set for the rest of your life.
Yep.
Yeah.
And you get to hang out in space. I mean, or at the very least, have like virtual reality goggles that you like put on then you're like looking at the robot in space.
Oh yeah, totally.
And you're
no,
like,
I'm pretty sure I would need it. I'm pretty sure I would need a full-time office on the International Space Station.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that way I can be close to my work. But if I can't, I definitely want to go the virtual reality route.
Yeah, otherwise imagine the commute.
Right. Any other thoughts on that story?
No, I think it was just interesting that these kind of things come along in groups sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, where it's a whole bunch of different stories that all interconnect.
Yeah,
and it's good that we're looking at how to repurpose satellites and use them for further use.
It kind of seems like we should have thought of some of this stuff a long time ago.
Well, we have thought about these a long time ago. We're just now being able to get into the technology that we can kind of, it's feasible. It's much more feasible.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh, this is how we could do it.
Now we really got to start thinking about this.
Yeah.
Now
so
we
we're
can,
thinking about now the technology is catching up and we're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I dig.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's take a quick pause here. No official sponsor for SciByte this week. So I just want to remind folks that one of the things you can do to help out Jupiter Broadcasting and help finance all of the fine productions we do is if you visit jupiterbroadcasting.com before you buy. So if you're going to shop over at, say, Amazon.com or Newegg or one of those sites, go over to JupiterBroadcasting.com, scroll all the way to the very, very bottom of the site, any page you're on, and you will find affiliate links for Amazon, US, UK, Newegg, ThinkGeek, Best Buy, Mint.com, and Audible, one of my personal favorites. If you click those before your shopping session, we get a small percentage of your shopping session. It's all anonymous, but it just helps out the show. And of course, you could also go over to our donate page if you'd like to contribute directly. The monthly contributions are always much appreciated and help us produce the shows when we don't have a sponsor. So thanks to everybody who takes a minute to do that.
Yep. It always makes me feel better about my Amazon and Audible addictions.
It's like, well, I might be
I'm addicted
money.
To it, but well, a little bit does go to Jupiter Broadcasting. I feel a little bit better about myself.
You're welcome. All right, well, let's move on to the SciByte News Bite. One of our biggest news bites I think we've had ever on the show. I'm really,
oh my goodness.
I'm looking forward to all of this. So our, what's our first story in the news bite this week?
Robonaut 2.
What?
Yes. We've mentioned it before on the network where it's the robotic astronaut essentially up on the space station. It's a humanoid robot.
Right.
The first dexterous humanoid robot in space.
Right. Right. We have talked about him before.
Yes. So he doesn't have any legs right now, but he's controlled, well, like I kind of mentioned a few minutes ago, with, you know, virtual reality on the ground, you know, goggles and handsets so that somebody can actually go out and dexterously maneuver and do things.
Oh,
and
cool.
So this week, he shook hands with the commander of the space station.
Man meets machine aboard the International Space Station as Expedition 30 Commander Dan Burbank reaches out and shakes the hand of Robonaut.
That is so cool.
Yep. And then I thought it was kind of funny and interesting. They had him, you know, essentially turned him to the camera and he spelled out in sign language, hello world.
Oh, so he can sign. Oh, that's
well,
neat.
His fingers are all dexterous.
Right.
So he can turn on switches and stuff. So they, you know, he spelled out hello world.
Huh. Now he doesn't have feet.
No, he does not have feet yet.
So this was the one that could hold a gun, huh?
Yeah, this was the picture that you thought it was a gun.
Yeah.
And we were worried about Skynet and everything. Right. And now he's on the space station, so.
Well, as long as they
as
keep
long
him
as he
there.
Doesn't start singing Daisy, we're okay.
Right.
It's
and,
all good.
And as long as he doesn't start claiming that there's something wrong with one of the radio antennas and somebody should go out there and take a look at it.
Yeah, always leave one person on board.
Right.
Near the plug. Like, yeah, see this plug? Uh-huh.
This is a great example.
Yeah,
this is
yeah.
one of those technologies that I'd like NASA to hammer out up in space and then bring it down to some sort of commercialized package that us consumers can get. Like, okay, why can't something like this be washing my dishes right now? Right? If it's got hands and thumbs and if it can hold a gun and sign words, it should be able to wash my dishes. And that's all they need to do is just work that out. And they can do that up on the International Space Station and then bring it down and then sell it as like the NASA Dishwasher 2000. I don't care.
I think this technology had something, I believe it has some sort of history with the medical profession. You know, they're having those remote, they're trying to get into the remote surgical.
I had a client who was one of the top neurologists in the United States. And he was really big into a remote robotics back surgery program where he would actually be able to operate on people's backs from a completely different location using some sort of remote control. I never actually got to see the system, but he was in newspapers about it and magazine covers and all kinds of stuff. Yeah, they're serious about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could have someone in a different part of the world and it be in real need of the surgery. And there's, you know, say there's somebody in Oklahoma that needs the surgery and the best doctor in the world is really in Europe somewhere. So, you know, instead of trying to convince somebody that they should make a, you know, 18-hour flight or however long it is, you know, to find somebody that it may not be soon enough for them. Can you have these sort of stations around different hospitals scattered about the world? And then
would you do it? If you needed to go in for an emergency surgery, would you be comfortable with a remote doctor?
By the time they actually got it so that it would be allowed near people.
Yeah, you would be.
It would be, I mean.
You'd hope it'd be pretty well tested.
Yeah, it's going to be really well tested.
What if it wasn't, though? I mean, I'm just curious. If it's brand new technology, if it's brand new, would you resist? Or would you kind of see, I think I might be like, if I need this surgery and I'm already in this state, what do I got to lose? That's probably what I...
Yeah. Well, that's where it comes in, is there's a certain type of drug that the FDA can sort of in the approval process, where if you're in a certain state and it's like, dying, drug might slow down dying. They're like, sure, take drug. It's not fully tested, but go ahead and take drug.
Right. Yeah. Worst case scenario is it just accelerates the problem you already have.
Yeah. Right. If there is a solution that is not good, that is definitely going to happen, and there's a chance of improving that solution.
Right.
I mean, if it prolongs your life or stops you from dying.
It's funny because I'd asked a buddy about this before. I said, would you do it? Because I'd just gotten back from the client. He said, no way. He's a coworker of mine. No way. I would never do it. I'd rather die. Because what if he's right in the middle of something and they cut and he loses connection and I just sit there and I bleed out on the table? No way.
Yeah, well, there's, even with the remote doctor, there will still be at the least nurses and somebody there to watch, you know, how anesthesiologists and nurses. I mean, even with a real doctor, there's like a whole team of, you know, nurses and techs and assistants, surgical assistants that are still there.
Oh, I know. I see the bills.
Yeah.
Now, they are actually planning to add a leg to this bad boy, to the R2, right? So that way he can kind of bounce around the space station and whatnot.
Yeah, they'll have some legs or some rollers on him. So the idea is that they can put him on the outside of the space station. They can kind of roll around, go fix something.
Totally. You know, he could go out into space and take care of stuff. That way the astronauts themselves don't have to risk it.
Yeah, if there is risk or if it's something that's really repetitive, then, you know, the astronauts don't have to do it. And that's part of the reason why they made it a dexterous robot, you know, a humanoid robot. Mm-hmm. Everyone's like, well, why would you do that? Because everything up there is already made for humans to flip switches, and all the tools are there for human hands. So instead of having to have a dual tool set for everything, one for robot, one for people, you could have one set of tools that the robot can use and the people can use.
That was the reason that Dr. Noonien Soong made Data in the likeness of himself, is because he figured everything was already built for humanoids. So to make the android get through life easier, he'd make him look like a humanoid and shaped like a humanoid.
Yep, Robodot 2 does not have a cool hairstyle quite yet.
Well, maybe that'll be Robodot 3.
Yeah, there are already others working. You know, and I believe there's one version that they're putting like on a little like rover vehicle. And there's another idea that says, shoot this off to Mars or the moon. Mm. And it kind of dune buggies around. And, you know, then you can lean over and pick up things and do things with dexterous hands. It doesn't even have to be an AI. It can, you know, it might be able to have some AI, but it could be, you know, a human looking at what's going on and picking things up.
Yeah, totally. You got some great links to videos of this Robonaut in action up on the space station. So if people want to go over to the show notes and check this thing out, so that way you know what the Harbinger of our desk will look like, you can go check that out.
You know when to run.
Run before it has legs.
Yes.
Any other thoughts on that story?
No, it's just kind of, it's interesting to see this kind of move forward in steps and see what's going to happen in the future with this and other robonauts.
And I joke and I jest, but I am serious in the sense that I think it's a huge benefit if that thing can go out and do some of those spacewalks. I mean, that's big.
Yeah, especially if there is the urgent need for a fix. If you have one of these outside the station, then he can go over there and start fixing it. An astronaut has to get the suit up, go through the airlock, do the cycle, then go out, then, you know, very carefully maneuver over to what's going on. You know, so there's some sort of delay, where if it was just the robot outside, rolls down his track, you know, starts work, maybe an astronaut goes out and, you know, assists, or what happens if there's a large solar flare and the radiation's high.
At the rate NASA funding's going, we might not be able to fund training astronauts anymore. We might only be able to send Robonauts up into space at the rate things are going.
Robonauts run the space station. Sounds like something in your nightmares.
Robots orbiting the Earth.
Yep, with a whole space station and science and all sorts of crazy things on board.
All right, should we move on to this next one, where science figures out once again how an ancient herbal remedy actually does work?
Yes.
Love it when these come up.
Yeah, we've had it happen a couple times now. So, an autoimmune disease, to start off with, back up a little, is when the immune system mistakes some part of your body as a pathogen and attacks it. So, for some people, you know, they twist their knee, and then that triggers it off. So then their body thinks, the knee is evil, we must take it out. And really, it's your knee, and you kind of like it to walk. Right. So there's this trade-off where these autoimmune diseases, the therapy for it is bringing down the immune system. But that's also brings down the immune system.
Yeah.
And they were looking at some various drugs, and Chinese herbalists for over 2,000 years have treated malaria using this root extract, commonly known as Chang Shan. I probably horribly butchered that.
Huh.
So doctors have looked at it, and they've kind of figured out the molecular secrets behind it. And there's an extract from it called, I practice this, Halofuginon.
Whoa.
Halofuginon.
Whoa, okay.
Okay. So it's a compound derived from this extract, and it can actually be used to treat autoimmune diseases. It's received sort of some FDA approval. It's got an orphan drug status. It already has it, because it's been used to treat a connective tissue disease since about 2000.
Hmm.
You know, it's the kind of drug that's approved for very rare medical conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot of people have this. So drugs that treat those kind of things can sort of bypass some of the system. You know, when there's only 50 people in the U.S. or less that need this specific type of drug.
Wow.
Then they say, yeah, you're okay. It's a really rare disease. We don't have to do wide-scale testing on this quite yet.
You know what else I learned? I learned this last week that if a drug company's formula for their drug is coming out of patent, which I guess like 10% of the pharmaceuticals on the market are going out of patent in 2012, that if they find a new use for that drug, they can re-patent the formula again and get another like 30 years or whatever it is of patent protection. I mean, it's kind of an interesting deal. So
I thought it was only 7 right now.
It might be what it is. I don't know what the length is, but I know that by reassigning what it can do, they can repatent again. I thought that was interesting. So you can see sometimes you can wonder, like, do they kind of just move forward on this so that way they can get that patent? Or is it really, you know, one of these things where they discover something and then now here we go. We're just going to use it for that. And I think this one's interesting because it kind of traces its roots back to that sort of older mythology. I don't know. I guess mythology isn't the right word, but older homeopathic medicine, I guess. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so we know that it's there. And it's interesting because they can sort of track what it's doing on a molecular and a cellular level.
Yeah.
So what it's doing is it's targeting and inhibiting a specific type of enzyme that's responsible for a certain type of protein being incorporated. And so this whole little process of, you know, a cell senses a limited supply of amino acids that build proteins. So it, you know, then it can block signals that promotes inflammation because inflamed tissues require a lot of protein. So it's like if you like were starving for a week, you know, and you twist your ankle, it might not inflame so much because that takes a lot of energy. And your body's like, yeah, sorry, ankle, not today.
Interesting. So starving can reduce inflammation.
Let's not use that as a medical
Well, I'm
process.
just
Jupiter
saying.
Broadcast does not condone starving someone
Right.
to reduce inflammation.
No, instead
But
just
it's
take
sort of,
ibuprofen and call it good.
yeah. But it's sort of reproducing that effect where it says we can trigger cells to fool them into thinking this is the case.
That's really interesting.
So you can trigger it so that it stops all the immune cells and the inflammation from attacking that specific thing. In addition, because it's not immunosuppressant. So it's not like it's reducing the inflammation and the autoimmune attack without lowering your immune system as a whole.
Isn't that interesting? It almost, I mean, it makes sense. It's like this plant has this specific capability where it just plugs right into our biology and just works with us.
Yeah. And it's interesting because it could be used in everything from inflammatory bowel disease to rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, psoriasis. And so it could be a really interesting new idea to treat autoimmune disorders. I have a family member that has an autoimmune type disorder. So it's kind of, I was reading this and I was like, whoa,
That would be
I gotta
awesome.
point this out to them.
Yeah.
And it could lead to, it could treat things, and then it could also lead into figuring out what's causing these things.
Yeah.
If you see the process, you can kind of start, how far can you reverse engineer it?
Right.
Figure out what's triggering this sort of a thing.
That could be really significant. It's interesting, these plants. You know, I always find it whenever it's the ancient, like the one that I think I like the most. What was that? In SciBite episode 19, we talked about snake oil and how they actually found some benefits to snake oil. And then there was also in SciBite 28, there was the anti-alcohol drug that also lessens hangovers, which was like kind of an old wives' tale. And
It's these kind of things where it's like, this works. Everyone goes, yeah, that does work. Or even, I think you mentioned in it in a Looking Back, where it was penicillin was used to start treating things. And in, Europe a long time ago, was you treated gangrenous infections by eating blue moldy bread.
Right.
And it
Surprise,
was that
surprise.
same type of thing. If it's kind of where these things work.
Right.
And when there wasn't a lot of doctors or science or a lot of this kind of stuff, some things worked really bad, but occasionally it's like, this works. All right, this works. Just take it.
If it
Don't
makes,
ask me why. Don't really care. Just take
science
it.
will figure it out later, and sometimes they do.
Sometimes science catches up and actually proves
There
that
you go.
there's a real reason why it worked.
There you have it. Well, what do you say we move right along to the next story in the news bite?
Yes. Spray on antennas.
Okay, tell me about this.
Antenna in a can. Like, there's going to be a Broadway production. Instead of hairspray, it'll be like
I got some bad
antennas.
reception. Could you spray a little bit of that over here? I like it.
I mean, this idea has had a history. There's already been, in 2001, researchers were looking at if you had some sort of template down, then you could spray something on the surface of it and make sort of, radio communicators or some sort of antenna like that. And so they've been continuing that. And one of the latest Google's Solve for X conferences, somebody had like a spray can that was, signal in a bottle. And essentially I mean, this isn't just like spray on, piece of metal right here. They sprayed this on a tree. And they were able to send a VHF signal 14 miles away
Whoa,
using
what? Are you
just the tree.
serious? Like they turned the tree into a giant antenna?
Well, just like I don't know if the whole tree, but they at least made that part of the tree that they sprayed an antenna.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
And it's so it does all sorts of stuff. So you could, what if you did this to paint on walls or buildings? Could you, and it increased your cell phone reception. What if they did this on the paint in the like tall grocery store aisles that kill your cell phone reception, especially when you're like not tall and they're like 2 inches of signal? to the sky for
you.
You're
trying to talk to your significant other to figure out if that's really what they wanted, or if you want them to get, if they want you to get the other thing since they don't quite have the right thing, and it's really frustrating.
Yeah, because then I end up standing in the grocery in the middle of an aisle with my head tilted at a 60-degree angle, sort of just talking, and everyone like wanders around me. I'm like, don't mind me.
Well, you know, unidentified 15919 in the chat room, he makes the joke about Darknet, but Darknet is actually the serious effort that people are trying to figure out how to build a new Darknet without going through some of the traditional methods we go through now.
Oh.
Something like this could be an interesting approach.
Yeah. Hmm. So, yeah, I mean, they've, you know, they're really happy about the kind of tests they've had, you know. They've... You know, they obviously sprayed the tree and it went 14 miles away. They've actually had luck underwater as well.
Oh my gosh, are you serious?
Yeah, they were able to spray, you know, something, stick it down to about periscope depth, and communicated over a nautical mile at about 50 megahertz.
Oh my gosh, this is so cool.
So if it could use underwater, then it could be the outside of buildings, because it could be used in weather. And not only that, but could use it in oceanographic research. Underwater welders could use it. You know, suddenly you could transmit underwater. I know my company did a remote little submersible. And, you know, trying to control it with radio signals to say, move this or move that. Underwater, not so much fun. We're like, yeah, we could do that. No, we have to poke a little hole, trail the antenna out, and just hook up to that.
Right. Because
you know what? Not going to be doing that real quick.
This is so interesting, too, because, you know, Microsoft and Google have both experimented with transmitting wireless internet over VHF signals as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, did you know that Google just bought, like, a couple of really big radio towers?
Whoa.
Yeah, some big transmitters. Google just made I don't know the details in the story, but people could Google search... Google buys radio transmitters, I suppose. And yeah, they're not saying what they're for, and nobody really knows, but they got some biggins, and I guess maybe, who knows, maybe they were really inspired by this.
Yeah. And yeah, so all these things are interesting. It's like, not only could you improve cell reception, but there's all sorts of things that you could improve. I've seen some articles where it's almost as much as, you know, military purposes. You know, they go out, they set out, spray this on the outside of your tent, and now you can actually have a mobile base communicating device. Or, you know, you set up in a building, spray, you know, some parts of the building, and voila, you have little antennas.
Camtech Enterprises? You think that's how you say it? The guys that are making this?
Camtech.
Man, they're going to, if this works, they're going to get rich.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, they're not the first to do this, and there are probably various companies doing this in different ways. But this one I found really interesting, because they, like, the picture they have, like, in the news is, like, a little spray can, just like a hairspray can or a paint can. It's just, like, sitting there, and there's, like, a little close-up of all the, you know, the metal embedded flakes, or however it is, the precise, you know, what's in there. So it's, you know, I just found it interesting, you know, like, have this, and you know, what if you're in a remote location? Or, you know, of course, I think, you know, if I have a testing site on the middle of, you know, 2 miles from nowhere, then, you know, I don't have, you know, good reception, then, you know, hey, there's a cell tower over there. You know, take my cardboard box or my plank of wood, spray it, and now suddenly I have much better cell reception.
Oh, wow. That is probably one of the most exciting stories. I think I my mind just boggles at all the different awesome possibilities for this.
I was really impressed how well they say it worked underwater as well.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You know, it was just like, well,
working underwater could be really big. I mean, cause,
that
would have a lot of military applications too.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And not only military, but, scientific research,
but definitely, you know, all the
submersibles. Well, yeah, definitely. But there, you know, the research submersibles.
Oh yeah.
You know, a lot of people think, well, what kind of thing is that? Or most people recognize the really deep sea stuff that goes and looks at the really crazy, out of this world locations with the crazy see through crabs and eight legged starfishes and all sorts of crazy stuff. Or the submersible that went down to the Titanic. And kind of flew around it and got all the video from that. So those kind of things could have much better signal.
Well, think how cool it could be, too, if it could be just integrated into, like, divers' equipment so that way they could broadcast little messages back and forth just using that or share data. You know, if you have a whole team down there that could be sending data around or sending... If you could actually transmit data, you could maybe send feeds to each other so you could see where the other guy's at. I mean, that could be really cool stuff.
Yeah. And it, you know, what if you had... And then... You know, they were able to transmit that farther. So you now you have a tiny transmitter on you, and this maybe it's a sprayed, you know, could you spray it on a piece of fabric all bundled up, and then should something happen, like, you know, your boat tries to escape without you, then could you, you know, toss this out?
Right.
And your small transmitter can reach so much farther then.
Hmm.
You know, rescue boats could get to you quicker, and you could call in a much farther distance than you could before.
Oh my gosh. And it's just sprays on, you know? I mean...
Yeah, it's just spray on.
That's great. That's awesome. All right, well, should we move on to the next story in the News Bite? All right. Oh boy. I'm going to let you take this one. Because I don't think I want to say what I think that says.
Nips of medicinal.
Okay.
Obviously I need to change the title to this story. Okay.
So medicinal fruit flies help kill parasites.
It might be a regional thing. It was, you know, the funny thing. Grandpa go out and take his medicinal, you know, liquor in a glass bottle.
Okay. So what does nips mean? Little?
Sips.
Oh, sips. Sips. Okay. Cause see, I was thinking you were talking about fruit fly nipples. I'm sorry, but I thought that's what you were talking about. I thought, no,
see,
I'm not going to read that.
You like, I'm not going to say that. I was like, oh no. Yeah, it's already changed. It's not there anymore. Okay. Sorry, people who look at the show notes, but you won't get to see that.
All right, what's going on with this one?
Okay. So common fruit fly, that little tiny annoying thing that swirls around, you know, bananas that you've left out a couple days too long that you want to try to laser beam shoot them, but they're really tiny. And so a study was published that fruit flies will actually seek out alcohol to kill bloodborne parasites. There's these wasps. I won't get into this too much because it's really creepy and yuck.
Kind of gross, yeah.
They can kind of steal the fruit flies, you know, little larva fruit flies, and make the little their little wasp babies there, and then they eat them and they grow up, and it's really gross.
That's super gross.
But but there's, you know, it's a bloodborne parasite that can lead to this. And the fruit flies, if the ones they did a study where the ones who ate the alcohol, drank the alcohol, were affected far less. There was like they survived at a much greater rate. Now, fruit flies in general live in a kind of 5-15% alcohol range. I mean, all this fermenting fruit that they kind of love.
Okay. I was like, how is that possible? Okay.
Yeah. So they pretty much, you know, are alcoholics that drink, you know, 5-15 proof stuff all the time.
That's awesome. I never thought of it. Fruit flies are totally booze heads, aren't they? They're a bunch of boozers.
Totally booze heads. But sometimes for these bloodborne parasites, it actually works for them.
Wow.
So there's some ideas like, well, how far can you take this and what is going on? Is there any human,
if the humans had a lot of alcohol in their system, would that kill parasites?
No.
That kind of thing? Oh.
No. More like, what's going on to make it and can we trigger it?
Oh, okay.
Like, we talked about the herbal cure that we talked about earlier, where it's fooling the body into think one thing is happening to make something good happen. Could you take that and be like, does it work in humans in any such way that we could make a drug that would fool the body into thinking that something is happening and turning it on so that it can go attack the bloodborne parasite?
Hmm. That is interesting, but it is kind of gross. The whole bloodborne parasite thing really bugs me.
Yeah, too much of the video and it's really creepy.
Yeah.
But it was a good video.
Yeah.
But I was like, anyone that's bugs, I mean, I try not to be a total girl about this, but some of those bug ones are just gross.
You know, there's only two kinds of bugs in this world that I don't like, and that's every single spider ever And then also fruit flies.
Oh.
Yeah.
See, spiders I will allow to live if I see them before they're inside my personal bubble. I'm like, oh, here, let me go get a piece of paper and I'll try to throw you outside.
You're freaking me out.
Ants that come within a mile of me, I scream like a tiny little schoolgirl.
Ants? Really? Ants are great. They're like little workers. They're like little soldiers. You can send them on tasks.
Yeah, I grew up where there were fire ants.
Oh, you know what? I had some of those in my neck of the woods, too. Those do suck.
And they weren't just ant, you know, hills. They were ant condominiums that were 3 feet wide. So, yeah, I don't like ants. my brain was triggered to see ant and run. Plus, I'm a slightly more allergic than the regular person.
Oh, boy.
So I was like, see ant, scream like little girl, run very fast like track star.
I don't run away from spiders, but I am very uncomfortable. I had a lot of bad spider things growing up. Spider situations. So left an impression on me.
Yeah, I had a couple myself. Yeah. But happier thoughts.
Hey, you know what? If they figure out how to combat blood-borne diseases and nasty things like that, then it's probably worth playing around with flies, right?
Yeah, somebody else can play around with them.
Yeah.
And then we'll see a fruit fly and we'll be like 0.1% less annoyed by them.
Hey, you know what? From now on, I'll be like, you're an alcoholic. I'll let it slide. You know, I'll be a little more forgiving. I'll be like, oh, I understand. You're probably drunk right now, little fruit fly.
See, another reason, you know, we were talking about why flies were attracted to beer before. Another reason why flies can't find themselves out of an open window.
I've always wondered. All right, I've got a light flashing here on the Cybite computer console here. Here we go. I'll do it. Yep, there it is. I'll dial this in. All right, looks like we got some viewer feedback this week. And this one was sent from our very own Alan. What'd he say?
Yes, he sent me an article, which is just one of the ways you can send in feedback. He sent me an article about desalinization of water. It's
what?
Removing all the salt from water, making seawater drinkable. There are various ways that you can do this. Most of them require quite a bit of energy. You know, you can do reverse osmosis or evaporation. Both of them require a lot of energy. You have to supply heaters, pressure pumps. So there's always been a move to try to find cheaper room temperature, energy efficient solutions.
Yeah, sure.
Looking into maybe nanomaterials or electrochemistry, some way that we could do it at a much, you know, without so much energy cost or actual cost. So what this particular technology is doing is it draws the ions from the seawater into a pair of electrodes. So they're using electricity to sort of take the positively and negatively charged bits of salt and sort of pull them towards the electrodes. And so you can, from there, you can release those into a separate stream. So you can sort of draw some close to you and then stick them down the downhill stream.
Huh.
And so you can have a little less salt water in this bit of water.
That's clever.
Mm-hmm. So right now, it's still only removing about 50% of the original salt. You need to get to about 98% for drinking water. But it is a very interesting step in the right direction that you could how they're pulling these out for a very low energy cost.
Yeah.
Essentially. So
it seems like you can even use this in a method. The way you're pulling those across barriers like that, I almost wonder if you could actually use it to create a charge. Wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah, it's a reverse of a different technology where they were sort of taking energy and dumping it into salt. Or I don't recall the exact details. I don't want to make science cry. But it's sort of a reverse of what was being used. Now we're using energy to take out the salt, and before there was using salt to produce some energy.
Right, okay.
So you could use the actual salt and water to sort of churn up a little bit of electrical charge. So now it's applying some amount of electricity to pull the salt out of the water.
Okay. A little different, but interesting. Interesting nonetheless.
Yeah.
Sea, getting salt out of seawater, always a good thing. All right, well, you know what? We've got an extra two-bite news round now. That was the extra one-up sound that you just got there.
Yeah.
NASA pit crews, huh? I didn't know that was necessary.
Yeah, this is a...
Race car kind of a thing?
This is something that a guy named Chris pointed me to.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think he co-hosts some science show.
You know, sometimes I try to play innocent, like, I've never heard of these stories, and then you just ruin it.
Yeah, totally outed you. But, so there's a NASA commercial crew program that's, you know, they are still doing things. I was very grumpy pants last week, but they are still doing things. And one of them is sort of partnering up with aerospace companies. And so what they're doing is they're grouping up with them and they're coordinating knowledge, you know, about the design, the development, the manufacture, the process of all these different type of launch space transportation systems. And the idea is not necessarily for NASA to say, we want X, make it for, you know, Y amount of money. Mm-hmm. The idea is more along the lines is what I was reading is that NASA goes out and says, or, you know, company, Jupiter company goes out and says, hey, NASA, we've got this really awesome idea and it's this.
Podcast
and NASA kind of looks at
space.
It. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so NASA looks at it and goes, that is a good idea. And it's investing money into them.
Okay.
It says, here you go. And it sort of partners people in the industry up with these companies. And so it's sort of making a non-governmental infrastructure of companies that can do specific details. You know, like when these space shuttle programs shut down, there were all these people that knew very specific types of...
They knew their job.
They knew their job. They knew the mechanics of it.
Right.
So what if in the future you had, maybe NASA has this kind of thing, or if a program shuts down, there are a couple of private industry companies that say, ooh, people with lots of experience, come,
right,
we're doing
course.
Something similar.
Sure, sure.
Your resumes are shiny. We have jobs for you.
That'd be ideal.
Or if it is just a private industry, then what if they can put the plugs in so there can be a booming private industry? You know, and if there could be something where NASA, you know, invests a little bit of startup capital and somebody maybe, you know, they have a pot of money that they can invest into various capitals. And they say, hey, if you make something really awesome out of this, then we get it at a reduced cost because, you know, we're an investor.
Right.
You know, and they can focus on very specific things then. And if there is an economical crunch, then they can pull back to some core things and private industry can keep things moving forward in other ways.
Right. Well, and also, doesn't it also leave the door open for other sources of funding? So maybe NASA is investing some money, but another commercial like Virgin Air could come in or Boeing could come in and also invest money. So that way they can get, you know, even more cash than what they could get from cash-limited NASA.
Hmm. Poor cash-limited places. But yeah, you have these ideas. And it's not always, you know, my company has had small business contracts from NASA and other government industries, you know, and we'll figure out this little niche of a technology, you know, and sometimes, you know, it's right for that and it works in this specific niche and it's awesome and we can kind of patent it for possible use and possible sale to various things.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened if a company did that or on occasion figured out a way to sort of repurpose the idea, like you repurpose a drug?
Mm-hmm.
Like, huh, this works for that. You know, it could also be really useful if you do this. And so then you go out and you say, hey, you know, who would invest in this?
Right.
And it'd be like finding a private investor. Because finding that first private investor into a company, really hard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
After you get that first...
Yeah, because you can go all those others and say, well, look, NASA's already invested in this, so...
Yeah. It's that first step in the door.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're just a startup company and you're looking for a major investor, you know, you're doing some energy or, you know, some sort of mechanical, chemical company. You're like, I've got this really great idea.
Spray on antennas.
Finding that first big investor is hard. Because once you find that person, then they have all their little rich investor buddy parties that they can be like, hey, this is a pretty cool company. And then the other people go like, yeah, that is a cool company. Here, have a little bit of money.
I kind of want to go to one of those parties. How do I get to a party like that? I bet they have the best appetizers ever.
Yeah. I mean, I think if we knew,
yeah,
we'd be.
Yeah. I wouldn't be
wouldn't
asking.
Be
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. If you have to ask, you'll never know.
Exactly. I understand. Well, let me throw a challenge at you. Let's just say I want to eat a burger in one hand and talk on my cell phone on the other hand. And also on my knee, I want to bounce a kid. So the only thing I have available to drive with is my mouth. Do you have a solution for me?
Well, possibly. Now, this kind of technology is more geared towards people who have no use of their hands, like spinal cord injury people.
Oh, okay, sure.
But it's an intraoral tongue drive system.
Say what?
Yeah, it means in the mouth. For people with severe spinal cord injuries, you know, high in the neck where there's no arms and no legs,
sure,
anything. They have what they call sip and puff. It's a little tube, and you can kind of sip it and puff it, and the air transfer sort of click switches, and you can kind of drive around and do things. But it's a little hard, and it's not very specifically accurate. What they've now got is
it's like
essentially
a mouse for the mouth?
Yeah, it is embedded into a denture application, just like you'd have, well, not denture, but you'd have, you know, the bracers, not braces, but the kind that goes into your mouth.
Like a retainer?
So, yeah, the retainer. Yeah. That's the word that was not in my brain. So you have, it's like a retainer that has, it's a smart retainer. And then you could have a piece of metal in your tongue and then use that to sort of
make contact.
Yeah, to make contact to, then you'd have a little, say an iPad hooked up to your wheelchair. And so then they could, you know, go around and move and tell it, you know, go forward, go left,
wow,
you know, go around all these different places and be able to maneuver possibly to a much higher degree. They've had some testing of this. They just kind of put some tongue bolts, you know, like tongue piercings in the mouth so that it wasn't, you know, very permanent. They put them in there and they've had some people go around and start being able to maneuver. And it was fairly promising for, you know, 30 minutes a week or whatever they had access to it. But it's kind of interesting thing. Now, one thing that I was wondering, you'd have to have a way to kind of turn it on or off. Otherwise, you'd go to be like, hey, mom. And you'd be like, drive off the,
click, click,
you know, yeah, edge of the sidewalk.
Format C <C-colon>. Like,
yeah.
I could see using something like this to switch the cameras while I'm doing the shows. You know, I gotta just move my tongue wherever I want. This one over here is right camera. That one over there is left camera.
Yeah, it'd be like happy science stream crashes because you forgot right to turn your tongue mouse off.
Right, right. I double clicked my right tooth and closed the window.
Yeah, not good.
Well, so this next story is pretty interesting because, you know, I'm doing a 30-day diet challenge, and a lot of people equate this diet that I'm on to the caveman diet, and you've got some caveman pollen here. This might be a good way for me to eat very, very authentically to my diet.
Yeah, it's... So, once upon a time, there was a squirrel, and it buried into the ground, and it filled its little hole with fruits and seeds and all its other things. And then it sat under 125 feet of permafrost for over 30,000 years.
Nice and fresh.
Yeah. So then Russian scientists have, you know, looking for, you know, woolly mouth mammoth preserved things in the Siberian tundra, have found quite a few of these little squirrel nests. And from one of these, they were able to harvest some plant material and actually grow a flower, germinate a flower, from some plant material in one of these.
It's like some Jurassic Park stuff there.
Yeah, it's not an extinct flower. It still is in Siberia, but it's the oldest plant material so far to have been rejuvenated, brought back to life. The last record was some palm, I believe some palm seeds that were just a little 2,000 years old. And these are over 30,000 years old.
Wow.
So it's kind of interesting because in addition to being cool and us being able to think, wow, if we do extract some woolly mammoth DNA, would we actually be able to do it? And it makes more sense and kind of leading on to a step that way. There is the Svalbard Global Seed Vault in northern Norway.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that has over 2 million seeds from 100 different nations stored and frozen there. And there have been some people who say, okay, yeah, nice, you have seeds on ice. Does that really mean we'll be able to do anything and put them later? This is definitely an indication that you could do something with frozen seeds.
Yeah.
That you could sort of bring something back should a plant epidemic go out and, you know, you lose a specific type of plant or crop.
You know, I'll tell you, we have a type of, I don't remember the name of it, but we have a type of plant that grows here on the side of the road in Washington. And there's another plant that's come in from another state. It's yellow and it kind of covers the ground. It's not native to Washington, and it's killing one of our native plants. It's just totally taking it over.
Yeah. Like the biggest plant like that that I can think of is kudzu in the south, where it's just, it comes in and it overruns everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, it overruns plants, you know, plant life. It can take over buildings and sort of climb over physical structures.
Right.
So there's that. But if you lose something from that kind of thing, then if you have these seeds on ice, then it's another proof that you could possibly rejuvenate those, which is kind of interesting and kind of promising.
Mm-hmm. That is. All right. Well, I think that's it for the two bite section, right? Is that what you call
yes.
it? I like that. The news bite,
just
two bite.
Little, it's kind of a combination of breaking news and just little things that interesting enough to say something about, but not enough to hold, like, make a big chunk out of.
Sure.
Nice, like a nice portion. It's just like a little snack.
Yeah, I like it.
Little snack news.
All right, what do you say we jump here in the time machine? Come on, step into the time machine here. Here we go.
Okay,
all right,
I'm
here we go.
Yep.
I'm holding on. Keep your hands inside. Don't. There you go.
Okay. I don't want to lose.
All right. Just a quick trip through the time machine this week. Our first science event that took place in this week in science takes us to February 26, 1935, 76 years ago. What happened, Heather?
That is right. The fight against tuberculosis. Dr. Selman Abraham Watson announced a discovery that there was an antibiotic, streptomycin, that was the first specific antibiotic that was effective against tuberculosis. He won the 1952 Nobel Prize for it.
Yeah.
Now, technically, which I kind of found kind of interesting looking into the story, it was sort of his 23-year-old grad student working alone in a basement laboratory.
No.
Now, of course, this is, you know, grad student, so the doctor, you know, looks at it, he checks it out, he says, yep, and then he makes his official announcement, but yeah, it was sort of kind of his lab and the specific, I think the specific test was made by the, you know, 23-year-old grad student.
Wow.
Alone in the basement.
A bit of a controversy there. All right, well, what do you say we go to February 26, 1946, 66 years ago? What happened?
So radar gives us better eyes in the skies. The feasibility of radar, which we know fairly well today, radio detection and ranging, it was demonstrated to the Air Ministry officials in England by Robert Watson Watt, a Scottish physicist, who had been working on radio wave detection to locate thunderstorms, you know, give bright-eyed warning to airmen and stuff. And in the process, he realized you could actually track aircraft, like enemy aircraft for air defense with it. And so he brought it forward to the Air Ministry, and they had a test that actually showed that a bomber flying on the main beam of a BBC shortwave radio gave back reflected signals three different occasions when it went overhead. So by the outbreak of World War II, the military had installed a chain of these radar stations so that they could, you know, defend the south coast of England and keep an eye on what was coming over so they could prevent a German invasion.
Yeah, it's interesting. You linked to a book here called The Invention That Changed the World, How a Small Group of Radar Pioneers Won the Second World War and Launched a Technology. Yeah. Radar, what a huge, significant changer. I watched a History Channel special on it, and really fascinating stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. Radar. All right.
Yeah.
Well, that is the past, so you know what now we need to do is look up into the sky for this week.
Yeah. So on Wednesday, February the 22nd, You might be able to spot Mercury about 30 minutes after sunset. It's going to be near the crescent moon, but you might need some binoculars to really see it. So, and kind of iffy. Mercury is a little bit harder to see than others.
Okay.
Especially if you're in near a city that has brighter lights.
It's a bit of an underperformer is what you're saying.
Yeah. Looking higher, of course, you have the constellation Orion and the brightest star in the sky, Sirius, that are up in the skies in general this week and this time of year. On Thursday, the crescent moon is getting a little bit thicker, and it's hanging off to the lower right side of Venus. Mercury is right over Mercury, should be right over Mercury in the twilight, but Venus is the much easier one to see.
Okay.
Friday, Jupiter and Venus form a line pointing down to the crescent moon.
Cool.
Venus is the brighter one, but Jupiter remains up top on the upper left.
Okay.
And then Saturday and Sunday, Venus, the 25th and the 26th, Jupiter, Venus, and the moon are kind of forming a triangle with Venus and Jupiter taking turns as to who's closer. Venus goes first, then Jupiter, because Jupiter is very polite and lets Venus go first.
That's nice of Jupiter.
And yeah, Jupiter's awesome. And in general, also kind of interesting is around this time is Mars will be rising in the east about twilight, and Saturn will be rising in the east real late at night and kind of being just before dawn. But they're a little bit dimmer than Venus and Jupiter. Mars, of course, being red, and Saturn through a pair of binoculars, you can actually kind of see little ears on the side of it being its rings. But there's a whole bunch of fun with Jupiter and Venus and the moon this week.
Right on. Those are good ones. Well, Heather, I think that just about brings us to the end of this week's show, doesn't it?
I think so.
Now, we should mention, so the people who might be a little new to the show, is we do 3 weeks worth of audio shows, and then on the last week of the month, we do a video podcast. So we do basically the same show with a little more slant towards things that fit better for video, and also if we have video questions, things like that, we play them. So that'll be a next week's episode of SciByte is video. And of course, you can join us live for those episodes of SciByte over at jblive.tv, 7:30 p.m. Pacific, and on Tuesdays.
That's right.
Heather, great show.
Great show.
All right. Well, everyone, thanks so much for tuning into this week's episode of SciByte. Be sure to go over to jupiterbroadcasting.com and check out all of the links that Heather included in the epic show notes. And then catch us live or download on demand Wednesday mornings over at jupiterbroadcasting.com. All right, Heather, have a great week.
Have a great week.
See you next week, everybody.